We're going to be looking at Matthew 15, verses 21 to 28. I'll read that short passage again. I want you to think, as I'm reading these words, what are the most shocking words that jump out of this passage to you? I won't ask you. I'll maybe get you to nod afterwards. But let's hear these words. And Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, "Send her away, for she's crying out after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered, "It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." She said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Then Jesus answered her, "O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire." And her daughter was healed instantly. What were the words that shocked you? Was it that Jesus did not answer her a word? Or maybe it was that reference to the little dogs? That was shocking. The three words that shocked me and excited me were not words that Jesus didn't or did say to the woman, but they were words that she said to him. And there are three of them where she says, "Yes, Lord, yet." Or if you like, "Yes, Lord, but." And I think those three words have to be some of the most astonishing words in all of the Bible. "Yes, Lord, I agree with you. You are completely right. But I have something that I can not only argue back with, but I can win the argument." Jesus seems to have pushed her away, doesn't he? He seems to have shut the door and bolted it. But she comes back with something that breaks the door down and smashes through every barrier. And she holds on to him and will not let him go. And it's called faith. And we have one of the greatest examples of great faith in all of the Gospels. "Yes, Lord, but." And the faith comes in the story of an anonymous woman who comes from the back of beyond. And her story is all the more remarkable in the light of what's gone before. Remember how Matthew opens this gospel? Looked at it a long, long time ago now, but it was the book of the story of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. That's the wrong way round, isn't it? Abraham should come first. He's older than David. But no, that's how Matthew tells the story. The book of the story of Jesus Christ, the son of David. He's going to tell you the story of Israel's great king who has come first to his people, then to the world, who is going to reign over everything and everywhere. And as we've turned the pages of Matthew's gospel, it seems that the reaction from Israel to her great king has largely been negative. Right from the start, Herod has tried to destroy him, the one who has been born king of the Jews. The cities where he did most of his mighty works, Chorazin, Bethsaida and Capernaum, have remained largely indifferent to him, not interested in him. And then the scribes and the Pharisees have become completely hostile toward him. Even in the end of chapter 12, his own family, they don't understand him. The end of chapter 13, his hometown of Nazareth, where he grew up, is offended by him. Nobody gets who he is. And so he has started to speak in parables to them. Parables are not stories that make the complicated simple at last. They are stories that hide the simple. And only those who are ready now to engage with the parable and let it do its work and get under our radars were the ones who get it. We've had the verbal parables of chapter 13, and then the visual parables, the feeding of the 5,000, the walking on the water in chapter 14. But the parables then continue into chapter 15, where Jesus speaks to the Pharisees. And Peter, verse 15, does not understand still what the parable is saying. But then finally, in our text, a Gentile woman is given a parable, little story, and she gets it. And she answers Jesus by using the parable. James Edwards says she is one of the first to hear and understand the parable of Jesus. She answers from within the parable. The Pharisees in the previous section we looked at last week have been so offended by what Jesus has said to them, as they've come to him with all of their rules and all of their credits. And Jesus she's offended them. But this woman, though you might think she has every right to be offended, I mean, a little dog? She isn't offended. She agrees with him, but she fights back with faith that appeals to grace, and she prevails where so many before her have stumbled. So let's hear her story. First of all, we've got the place, verse 21. Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. We've had this word before, haven't we? He withdrew, and that was in chapter 14, verse 13. He had gone away from the crowds, and we saw as we put the Gospels together that he was going to take his disciples on a spiritual retreat. He was going to give them a break. They'd been working hard, and they were going to come apart for a while, and they were going to have a holiday together. And they'd crossed over the Sea of Galilee from the west to the northeast, and the crowds had all followed them. So when they got off the boat, there were just hordes of people gate-crashing the holiday. So Jesus had ended up teaching them and feeding them, and then they'd wanted to make him king, so he'd had to withdraw again from them because they didn't understand what sort of king he really was. And I think finally he's managing to take the disciples on that retreat. They've gone this time north, right out of Israel, into the region of Tyre and Sidon. No crowds are going to come looking for him here. This is a godless, dark, pagan place. Jesus is not on home territory now. And yet it's a place that had some history in the Old Testament. When Luke tells the account of Jesus' rejection in his hometown of Nazareth, that we get in Matthew chapter 13, the end of, Luke tells us what had really, really upset Nazareth. And it had been when Jesus said, "Truly, I say to you, no prophet is acceptable in his hometown. But in truth, I tell you, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah when the heavens were shut, 3 years and 6 months, and a great famine came over all the land. And Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the region of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. And there were many lepers in Israel in the time of the prophet Elisha, and none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian." That's happened just a few weeks earlier. He said those words, and now Jesus is in that very, very region, the region of Sidon. It's a spiritually dark place, but a place where once, 800 years earlier, the God of Israel had gone outside of Israel and helped a poor Canaanite widow. You might wonder how long that story had stayed in the memories of Sidonian villages. It was quite an event, wasn't it? How many times had that story been retold around Sidonian fireplaces? The time that the God of Israel came to visit and helped one of our own. And here is Jesus, back in that very same place. And it strikes me that for all his tough words, which ultimately he uses to draw out her great faith, that really he'd come looking for her long before she came looking for him. Secondly, then, let's look at the person. Verse 22. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." We're looking at a desperate person here. Her daughter, the Greek is wickedly oppressed by a demon. This poor girl is just helpless in the face of constant assaults by the powers of darkness. Must have been terrible for the girl. This spiritual oppression constantly. And yet also it must have been terrible for the one who loved the girl, mustn't it? For the mum, to see her daughter being destroyed by the power of evil. We don't know the backstory to this, but we're just given the present grim reality. And then this woman, isn't she a hopeless person? She's a Canaanite. She's an outsider. She doesn't have the rich heritage of the scribes and the Pharisees that we met at the beginning of the chapter. She's not a woman who can trace her family tree back to Abraham and all the covenant promises of God. She's one who can face her family tree back to Canaan, cursed Canaan, in Genesis chapter 9. And yet she's a remarkable woman. She comes to Jesus asking for mercy. She's not going to plead on the basis of what a wonderful person she's been and how she has worked hard and she deserves a reward from Jesus. She doesn't plead any worth of her own, but she begs for mercy because she, and not many people in Matthew's gospel have done this yet, she recognizes the greatness and the glory of Jesus. She knows that there's hope in Jesus. Did it shock you how she addressed Jesus? It did me. This woman said, "O Lord, Son of David." She's a Canaanitess. And yet, she recognizes this is Israel's great king. She recognizes that this is David's greater son. That means that she recognizes that he is the Christ of the Old Testament, the King of Israel. I think I'm right in saying the only previous occasion in Matthew's gospel where people have actually addressed Jesus as the Son of David was back in chapter 9, when two men cried out words, the very words that this woman echoes here. "Have mercy on us, Son of David." That's something, isn't it? The only three people in Matthew's gospel who have got that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of David so far, are two people who couldn't see and yet could see, and the outsider from the dark, benighted region of Sidon. And she sees exactly who he is. I wonder how. I don't know. Matthew doesn't tell me. I wish he did. But he doesn't. But he does tell me what is important here. He tells me that she did know who he is. And she knew enough to know that there was hope of mercy in Jesus the King. That he could help her if he wanted, because he is Lord and his power is greater than the greatest powers of darkness. But thirdly, we've got the put down. How will Jesus respond? Well, if you'd never read the story, you'd be flabbergasted, wouldn't you? I'm almost envious of someone who has come and has never read this before. Because it's so shocking. Jesus said nothing to her. He did not answer her a word. Is this the first time that a cry to God for mercy has ever fallen on deaf ears? What's happened to the Jesus that we've met over and over again, who was filled with compassion when he looked at the crowds? Are there some people then that Jesus just doesn't care about? Or is Sidon beyond the reach of God's compassion? Well, no, he cares. As I've already argued, she is the reason that he's there. But he's going to work to his timetable. And first of all, he says nothing. It's the disciples who now intervene, and they come to Jesus and they beg him to send her away. Probably they're saying, look, Jesus, just give her what she's asking for and then send her away, because she's now crying out after us. She's following us round and shouting out. And Jesus says to them, that's to the disciples, not to her, he says, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And the implication is they have to go out and relay this message to the woman, because he didn't say it to her. Oh, I wouldn't have fancied that task, would you? Imagine the disciples doing rock, paper, scissors to see who gets the task of going out to this desperate woman and saying, sorry, lady, you're not part of the lost tribe of Israel. Sorry, woman, this isn't for you. I want you for just a second to compare the scene that we've got here now with the story of the other man that Jesus mentioned when he was preaching at Nazareth. He mentioned the Sidonian widow, and he also mentioned Naaman, didn't he? The Syrian, the leper. Syria was the same region. And you remember the story? Naaman was this really important man. He was the great commander of the Syrian army, and he'd been struck down with leprosy. And he ended up going to Elisha. And he turns up at Elisha's door with this vast gift that he's going to give to Elisha. And Elisha didn't even bother to come out. The message is sent up to him in his study, and Elisha doesn't say a word to him. He just probably gets his pen, writes out the prescription, one dip in the Jordan River 7 times, hands it to his servant, and his servant takes it outside. And Naaman was furious about this. He thought, at least the prophet is going to come out and do some arm waving and shout some incantations and do something. Not send out a little servant with an offensive message of washing in the filthy Jordan 7 times. And Naaman was so offended by his treatment by God's servant that he was ready to storm off in a huff and turn his back on the whole scene. He'd been given the answer, but through a servant? Didn't God know who he was? And he would have marched right away from God's grace were it not for the wise counsel of his own servants. But look at our woman. She gets the servants coming out there, but she doesn't get the answer. Just a put down. But she isn't put off. She isn't offended. She doesn't storm off. Verse 25, she just comes closer. You can't push this woman away, can you? She came in and she kneels before him, and she's still saying, Lord, help me. And fourthly, we've got a parable. Verse 26, finally Jesus does answer her, and he says, it's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Jesus tells her a story. He gives her a parable to see how she'll respond. It's the story of family life and priorities. In any house, the father's responsibility is first to the children and then to the pets. Well, in most houses, it's that way around. I hope it is in your house. You know, the pets come second, the little dogs. But if he is who she claims to believe he is the son of David, then his responsibility first is to Israel, because he's Israel's king. And he comes first to his own family. His mission field during his life was not Rome. Never went there. Never went to Athens. He never went to London or Londinium. He largely spent his time in Galilee and Judea. It's not that Jesus doesn't care about the Gentile world. He couldn't care more. He cares passionately about it. But remember the order at the beginning of Matthew's gospel. He is the son of David, Israel's king, and the son of Abraham, the one in whom all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. But there's an order to his mission. It comes out more clearly in Mark's account, where he says, "Let the children be fed first. Wait your turn, woman." Now, to our ears, what he says to her might seem so offensive. I preached on this text from Mark's Gospel not long after I came to Netley, and one lady was so offended by what it was saying, she never came back. And it might sound harsh, it might sound rude, what he says to her, but how will she respond to the parable? Will it go over her head? And she'll say, "I don't really know what you're talking about." Or will she get it? And if she does get it, it's going to go one of two ways, isn't it? She'll either be furious and outraged, and she'll say, "Look, I get the parable, but according to your story, I'm not family. I'm the little dog under the table. How dare you speak to me like that? I've got rights. I've got dignity. Okay, I might not have been born a Jewess. I didn't have much choice about that, but I'm a lot better than some of the people down south. I can see their hypocrisy from up here, and I've been respectful to you, Jesus. I recognised you for who you are. I called you Lord. I'm a hard-working mum who cares for my daughter, and all I asked from you was mercy. And you treat me like this? I'm expecting to hear a door being slammed, aren't you?" And an enraged Sidonian woman storming away from Jesus. But that's just not how she responds. And fifthly and finally, we've got her perception. "Yes, Lord," she says, "but I get it. I agree with what you're saying, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." She gets inside the parable and she starts to use it and to plead it. She's saying, "I know, Lord, I'm not a child with a place at the table. I don't have any rights, but I know who you are, and you're still Lord to me. And I know that there's enough grace, enough mercy, enough love for the undeserving, that crumbs might fall from the table to the little dogs, and I want it right now. I don't deserve it. I don't earn it. But you have it. And I'm pleading with you on the basis of who you are, not what I've done." And she comes just with faith. And that's just what Jesus wanted. And he calls it great faith. "Oh, woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire." And her daughter was healed instantly. I love her indefatigable, relentless, stubborn faith that Jesus draws out as he seems to put all of these obstacles in her way to show her that she comes to him for who he is, not what she has done. And I wonder, would you or I have made it through this parable? Or would you have snapped at one point? Have you made it through the parable? How did you respond last week when Jesus said, the problem is not outside of you? You think it is. You think the problem is always out there. It's always other people. You're always complaining about this world. And yet the problem isn't always out there. The real problem is in here. Jesus said, the real problem is you. You have a sinful heart. And no matter how many rules you think you keep, you're a sinner who is cut off from God. You've not earned your place at the family table. You have no rights with God. You've earned nothing from God. In my estimation, if he were to call me one of the little dogs under the table, that would be far too high. I'm a very, very, very great sinner who is in need of a very, very great saviour. And being confronted with that, you haven't earned anything. You don't deserve anything to be able to come back and say, yes, Lord, that's correct. Yet, there's more than enough grace with you. More than enough crumbs of grace to reach sinners like us. Hasn't Matthew already hinted at this at the feeding of the 5,000? When they were all filled and there were still 12 baskets full left over. There was going to be more than enough to go round. Our hope is not on what we've done, but in Jesus and what he's done. You want to talk about rights? Then you look at Jesus. He's the one who has all the rights. And what did he do with them? He laid them aside for your sake. He made himself nothing. He humbled himself. He took the lowest position possible to hand to you the greatest right of all, the right to be called the children of God. It cost him everything. The great son of David, the great son of God, was despised and rejected that we might be cherished and accepted. He was forsaken on a cursed cross so those who ought to have been forsaken might be welcomed into the family. And it isn't really crumbs of grace that fall from the table, is it? It's a great flood of grace that sweeps across the world as Jesus is ready to save all, Jew and Gentile, who come to him in faith. In faith into what he's done for us. We're not left as the little pet dogs hoping for crumbs. He seats us now at his table. He'll do that this morning. He calls us family. And he reminds us of what he's given to us, which is himself. His body broken for us. His blood poured out for the forgiveness of our sins. How could we ever think he didn't care when he cared so much that he would give everything for this woman? I wonder when he was saying these hard words, what his eyes looked like. You see something in someone's eyes, don't you? I imagine that his eyes encouraged her because they would have still been filled with compassion, because he couldn't look on the desperate without feeling compassion. He cared so much for her. He cares for us. But do we share her faith? When Jesus says to us, look, according to the law, you simply cannot earn your place at the table. Do we come back and say, yes, Lord, but we know you give a place at your table. You give us a place in your family. And we're here because of who you are and because of what you've done. And that is how we will come to you today. And it's how we'll come to you tomorrow. And how we'll come to you on our last day. And how we'll meet you, trusting in what you've done for us. Not what we've done for you. Let's sing our last song before we sit at the table, which is What Gift of Grace Is Jesus, Our Redeemer.